This is Democracy in Crisis. I'm Baynard Woods.
And this is Mark Steiner right here from the Center for Emerging Media. And the Mark Steiner Show, I might add.
That's
you
right.
Mind, you mind if I add that, do you?
Yes, not at all. We've been airing it on the radio. I'm always grateful to be on the air through the city of Baltimore, where you don't have to have a computer. One of the best forms of communication possible, radio.
There we are. So?
So, yeah, this week we're not even having a guest this week because there's just so much for us to talk about, and making it hard for radio right off the bat.
You really had nothing. You got to cut. You just got to bleep.
I mean,
you just got to bleep. They have to edit this. Then they got three bleeps.
But there's just so much FCC approved language that we have to sort of, that we kind of wanted to be able to work through. And I've been watching the original Saturday Night Lives. My TV at night sometimes when I'm
trying to... You're talking about the new ones about Trump?
No, the original ones going back to like the 1975.
Like John Belushi and those
guys?
Yeah,
they're all up for streaming. And it's really interesting that they didn't have a standard format at first where it's like the cold intro, or the cold open, the monologue, then the music at a certain number of minutes. It was a lot more free form at how it worked. And so I feel like that's kind of good for us to keep a little... And it feels better that way. You don't feel the expectation. So... We decided instead of being so tight on having to stay on one topic that we were going to kind of be able to talk about a lot of stuff because we have this will be coming out on Thursday and we should have the budget, the spending budget released by the Trump campaign.
Well, no, because the reason you say that is because everything they do feels like they're still in campaign mode.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, governing is not what they want. Ungoverning, de-governing, disgoverning. Eliminating governing is what they want.
Yeah, totally. The deconstruction of government or of the administrative state, as Bannon puts it. And yeah, I mean the way it looks like from, I don't know what you've been hearing, but like I'm hearing the State Department's budget will be cut by up to 40%. The Post has had that amazing story this week about the budget cuts, and they gave. I mean. The language that they used there was just chilling. The proposal would shake the federal government to its core.
Right. I mean, and they are very clear about what they want to do. I mean, when they talk about deconstructing the administrative state, I was thinking about this. So all the other programs we've done about the history of this country and the interview we just did earlier with Calvin Baker, the great novelist about the piece he wrote in Harper's, there are roots to this, and these roots are deep. So if you think about the deconstruction of the state that they want to do, to taking away all the power of the federal government to do anything, to intervene in the environment, to intervene with corporations, to fight for voting rights, all the things that they want to see ended, the roots of this go right back to the beginning of this country when we debated over what this country was supposed to be, free or slave. And those who believed in the enslavement of Africans and the destruction of native people and taking whatever they wanted to take believed in this document, the doctrine of states' rights. And, you know, if we live in a better world, I might think, oh, I would love libertarianism because the state gets on my nerves as well. I understand not liking the state, right?
Right. If they were about our individual freedom, everyone's freedom, but they're not.
It's not. It's about the freedom of corporations and the wealthy to do what the hell they want to do, masking it in our rights, the states' rights, to get rid of the administrative state so they can do what they want, destroy the environment, and run roughshod over the people. And that's what people don't seem to get. And because all the people who love individual freedom who voted for Trump can get just as screwed as everybody else when they destroy the state.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about that same point you were making. I went down last Friday to the Native Nations Rising.
Oh, you went down? We missed that. I really wanted to be there.
It was amazing. It was really and seeing, like, with the White House, the backdrop of the White House behind them, seeing members of so many different Native nations coming together and speaking or dancing or just holding up their fists in front of the White House. It really made me think that is, I mean, the president, the only one that Trump seems to express admiration for is Andrew Jackson.
Go ahead. Because Andrew Jackson, to me, is the epitome of the contradiction of our country, right? Because on the one hand, Andrew Jackson is emblazoned in American history as the man who democratized America, gave the vote to the regular working man, took it away from the wealthy, and created this populist democracy. Populist democracy for white men is who he made it for. The part we don't get about Jackson is he not only was a slave owner, but he captured enslaved people who tried to go to freedom. He practiced genocide against Native Americans. He was a deep believer in slavery, and so the contradictions are embodied in Jackson himself.
And those same things that we see with this populist rhetoric now. And, I mean, the other thing that's a very big concern with the Trump administration is, you know, Jackson was the courts ruled on the federal bank issue, that the courts ruled against Jackson, and he said, who's going to enforce it?
He said, right, you can pass the law, but tough.
Yeah, yeah. I worry that that's one of the things that he sees precedent in as well. And so I was thinking a lot about that. But I also was a little bit inspired. It was the most hopeful thing I saw to see after going through the same that we're starting to feel as white men now, these Native Americans who had come together, who had suffered a defeat now after this grueling winter at Standing Rock, and were there in front of the White House ready to, like, to them this was the beginning of all of them coming together to save the water for us. The thing I heard over and over again is, this isn't about Native issues. We're doing this for you now.
Well, and that is it. And that's what we have, that I think we have to really understand, that the cutting edge of change in this country has come from the fight for freedom from the black world, has come from the fight for freedom of Native people, not just from the fight for freedom that working people in this country and immigrants made. It's all in, but the spear of it, the tip of the point of the spear of freedom, has come from that struggle around freedom. If you look at what the earliest writings of the men who wrote the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Constitutional Convention back in the 1700s, that the abolitionists were clear that our love of freedom is coming from the right of the freedom struggle that enslaved Africans are making. They were very clear about that. And that's, we have to understand that. And so these contradictions are deep in this country. I mean, they're really – I mean, on the one hand, I was talking about Calvin Becker, on one hand you have the roots of the revolution are in abolition and freedom and in enabling the enslavers to keep enslavement alive. Yeah. Contradictions have been here from the very beginning. And that's the battle we're having now. I mean, this is – The definition of who we are as Americans is what we're fighting about at this moment.
Totally. And those battles, I mean, keep fragmenting into smaller. So on the left, we're having it. What does it mean to, you know, James Walcott had this piece come out last week, who had been a Village Voice writer with Norman Mailer and stuff, now is a columnist for Vanity Fair, attacking the alt-left and coining this alt-left, which is sort of annoying to those of us who you know, this podcast goes along with a column in a lot of alt weeklies. And so first you have the Nazis take the thing, and now you have the centrist Wolcotts and stuff saying, oh, these people on the left who are against neoliberalism. So you have it there. You have it on the conservative side of, I mean, going back to, like, in the 50s, there was this Peter Varick has this amazing book called The Unadjusted Man. And he was the first person at the same time as Buckley to start using conservative in an American sense. And he argued against all of the McCarthy, Goldwater, Reagan sort of wannabe call themselves conservatives then, that the New Deal had been around long enough by the 50s that it was an entrenched part of an American culture, and that you were a radical, not a conservative, if you wanted to roll back the New Deal. And, like, someone needs to be saying that to the conservatives now. This is the most radical thing. I mean, this Post story points out that we will not have seen government this small after this budget Thursday, if it comes through, since the end of World War II.
I think we have to stop the alt-weeklies that air this podcast and air your column, or the piece you write every week. Maybe have to stop calling themselves alt-weeklies and just becoming the weeklies, because they speak with a broader voice than just an alternative, right? We don't want to, that's stuck in this corner, but I talk a bit about what inspired you to write. You want to get into this whole question of the destruction of the administrative state, what it means, what Bannon means, what Stephen Miller means, what Stephen Bannon means, what they're really trying to do. I mean, because that's what you wrote about, and I'm just curious about, you know, what your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I mean, I was at CPAC a few weeks ago when Bannon made one of his sort of rare speeches. And he said there, one of the first things he said that the regime was for was the deconstruction of the administrative state. And I was a philosophy nerd and stuff before. And so, like, deconstruction, I'm like, oh, does he mean anything like what Derrida and these people mean? And then I'm you know, then, but immediately he follows it up by saying, if you look at these cabinet nominees, they were selected for a reason, and that reason is deconstruction. And so then as you start looking at what the cabinet, all the cabinet appointments are doing, you see that that's the case. You have DeVos, who's against public education, essentially. You have, as we talked about last week on the podcast, with Emily Bazelon. You should check it out if you haven't heard that one. We talked a lot about what Jeff Sessions is doing with the Department of Justice and the Civil Rights Division there. And, I mean, this week Scott Pruitt came out and said that he doesn't believe in that humans have a cause in climate change.
Right.
So like, and he's heading the EPA. So all of these agencies are we can see it in the picks, but then I think there's and they also then they're not filling the positions in there, and they're running them with these appointees from, you know, beachheads. One of our first columns in this was about beachheads and these teams that they send in and using this military language. And ProPublica put out an amazing piece this week that had 400 of the beachheads that are really running these organizations now. And so all of those things sort of paint a roadmap to what we're looking at and what kind of stripping away at what the state does on the one hand. But like you said, like, they're not going to shrink police forces. They're not going to be shrinking the military.
No.
All of the budget that's coming from those places are going there.
And the other piece of this is important. You know, that one of the things that ProPublica also wrote about in this article was that Trump came in with this big, blazing mouth talking about swamp denizens and draining the swamp, right? So these 400 people you're talking about that are going to actually run different parts of the government, then deconstruct it, they are the denizens, right? I mean, he has this guy, Alexander Campo, going to DHH, who was a lobbyist for Blue Shield Blue Cross for Fresnesius Medical Care, a German company that he lobbied for them. Timothy Clark, working for Tom Price, health secretary, past clients of the biggest pharma trade group in the country. Person after person after person was a lobbyist. Justin McElroy, working for the Department of Defense. Who did he lobby for? Defense contractors. So, and that's who's running the government.
Yeah.
And it's always been that way in a sense, but this is even more insidious. Just because they're there to make as much money as they can, surreptitiously, for the people who they lobbied for, while they destroy government, they can stop them from having the regulations to safeguard human beings' lives and our environment. I mean, that's what we're about. That's what we're watching.
Yeah, and I mean, two places that we're going to see it coming up that it may be, and for one of the other things that really interested me about this issue is when Gorsuch was appointed to be Supreme Court Justice, you know, one of the striking things about Gorsuch is he's one of the few people that is at that level of the judiciary who is against what's called the Chevron Doctrine and who's written against the Chevron Doctrine a lot. And that's a rule that gives precedence to administrative officers and administrative functions in deciding rules that are very technical. So it would allow, if a law is passed, Congress will pass a law and it will allow the EPA to determine what some of the particulars of that law mean if it's an environmental law, because it's a really technical issue. And so judges usually give deference to the administration, that the administrative branch agency that is relevant there. And so Gorsuch is against that. And that might seem like, oh, this is a good stand for the judiciary against Trump's seeming attempt to seize more power for the executive. It gave me a bit of hope for a minute. But then I saw, once I heard this Bannon comment, I saw what's really going on is that they're picking people like Gorsuch in order to eliminate the power of the agencies while making the power of the executive more capricious and have less arms, but a stronger reach from the two arms of. And so we see it again. Just last week on Wednesday, we had Noel Francisco was named to be the and this guy is, we'll talk about his shadiness a little bit. But so he was named to be the Solicitor General. And he also is really has written at length against the administrative state.
So the thing about this is that's so scary is that it's like some of these stories are almost flying under the radar. And you've got somebody who has fought against voting rights now as Attorney General and and wants to dismantle the Office of Civil Rights within the Justice Department. You've got a man running the EPA who wants to dismantle the EPA. As you said earlier, you've got a woman now running the Department of Education who doesn't believe in public education. And even though they can pass all the laws to change everything easily, they can whittle it down by not enforcing regulations, by taking money out of agencies to do the enforcing. And you can see the devolution taking place in front of your eyes. This is not a small matter. That's why it's I think that many people did not take Donald Trump and the people around him seriously. But the moment I remember I saw Steve Bannon there and Steve Miller around him, I knew that this was a very dangerous scenario. I mean, Steve Bannon is, whether he's really a white nationalist or not, I'm not sure. But I do know that he plays with white nationalists, and I do know that's the world he likes to surround himself in. And they are not just advising, they're running the government.
Yeah.
They're running the White House.
And I mean, not only such radical ideas, but in their cases, woefully inexperienced, no idea about the effects that these things are going to, that they want to do are going to have. And it seems like just no concern. Like those two seem like the ultimate cynics. And even, I mean, the ones who seem like the most decent of them, like Wilbur Ross, say, the Commerce Secretary, who's one of the world's biggest collectors of surrealist art. He's a big fan of Magritte. Some of the workers here from Sparrow's Point at the Bethlehem Steel in Baltimore love him. Others hate him just as much. But because he gave them a few more years in the way that his company would buy out. But Trump ran on this idea of and keeps talking about bringing coal mining jobs back and stuff. So we can see when we look at so Ross's International Coal Group owned the Sago mine, which in 2006 had an explosion and collapse. And though that's what happens to miners when we deregulate the way that they want to. It's not that you have more jobs. It's that the people who have the jobs, those jobs become much more dangerous. And guess who defended in the congressional inquiry into the Sago mine disaster?
Do tell.
It was Noel Francisco, the new Solicitor General, defended against the United States, Wilbur Ross's company, against any liability in that. So this is when they want to get rid of the administrative state. They want to get rid of OSHA regulations,
right?
EPA regulations, and we can see in Sago where that leads.
So you know, it's important for us to recognize all this. The question is, what do you do about it? I mean, you know, this is where the opposition is coming from. And we don't know what the opposition is coming from, I mean to say. I mean, you've got Democrats. They seem to appear to be in real disarray over what to do in response to this onslaught. They are minority everywhere. They, like labor unions and Democrats, both groups have failed to organize over the years to build their base in any organized fashion. So they're up against this group that has been organizing since the 1968, since 1970, when they really said, okay, we have to stop this. These 60s stuff has got to stop. You know, hippies and smoking dope and black folks wanting freedom and not letting us drill because of the environment. We're going to stop these people. And they did their best to do it over the last 46 years, and now they have the hen house. Now they're in it. Now they run it. Now they own it.
Yeah. It is, I mean, what the Democrats, they seem to be offering a woefully bad response. Although people, individual citizens and the Native Nations coming together and the spontaneous demonstrations at airports and stuff, that's where I feel like Democrats need to, rather than thinking John Lewis is great because of what John Lewis did 50 years ago, which certainly is great, on Bloody Sunday marching across the Pettus Bridge, but like, they could actually do that now. You know, Tom Perez could go out and get between ICE and someone that ICE is trying to arrest. Any single one of those Democrats, they should be doing that right now. It should become a badge of honor within Congress. You're the only Democratic congressperson who hasn't been arrested yet? No one will sit with your ass at lunch, man. You know, and instead they're all like, not a single one has been arrested. The fuck are they thinking? But you know what? I mean, like, what we should say to them is like, we're not going to be sitting with your ass at lunch, and or pay him for your lunch if you guys don't start doing something like that, because it's really not the kind of fight that can be had solely legislatively right now.
Well, I think part of it also, when we talk about the devolution of government, is also in some ways the struggle for a different kind of – the struggle for the America that I think most people in this country do want devolves to the states, right? I mean, it becomes what we do locally to stand up against what they're doing, so that it evolves into a much more national movement. I mean, that's where I think it lives at the moment, which is why you're seeing so many people who were for Sanders and many people who were part of the Black Lives Matter movement diving into state politics to take over, to push back. That's the dynamic going on that few people are talking about. The Wall Street Journal had a huge article about it recently, and I think that's probably what has to happen because there's no national presence at the moment at all.
And that, I mean, it almost that lack of national presence also is what gives the right this weird. I mean, I spend a lot of time on right wing Twitter and stuff these days, and
better you than me.
And the extent to which they're still obsessed with Obama, and they now are you know, Obama was really a CIA agent who had this name and then that name and then this name and the deep state, like all of this. I think they've found with this idea of the deep state a way to justify what they're doing with what they wanted to do all along and what we're talking about, getting rid of you know, the administrative state, getting rid of the parts of government that function and aren't just by the whim of this, you know, of the strongman leader.
I mean, and think about what was behind Bannon and Breitbart and the Mercers, these billionaire right-wingers who backed him and that publication are now in the thick of things with them. I mean, we're not just talking about conservatives who believe in a certain way of life in America that we may not agree with, but we're talking about absolute extremists, people who do not like having immigrants in this country, who do not like Mexicans, who do not like black folks, who don't give a shit about the environment. They're now in control, and they are making the decisions about where we go. That's how dangerous it is. These people on the not just these people are far right wingers bringing in all these nationalist elements. Every time we do something, the hurrah goes up from the white nationalists. He talks about himself being an economic nationalist. Bannon did, right?
So, but more than economic nationalist, he said we're not just an economy, a nation with an economy. We're a nation with a purpose and a point. So he was really espousing economic nationalism plus cultural nationalism, which just makes it more scary. So let's back up a second.
Okay.
And kind of maybe go big picture as we start to go out here. And I mean, what you were just saying is that whole rap there is chilling. And I'm always trying to get my head around this, and it's the dumb sort of age-old philosophical question of the problem of evil. How are people evil? And I'm going to use that word. And usually those us philosophical types are sitting around pondering that while some comes up and cuts our head off. So, like, it doesn't go that far sometimes. But, I mean, what do you think they're thinking when they're making these decisions to, strip rights from a lot of people, possibly imprison more and more increasing numbers of people, cause the destruction of the planet. What would you guess they're thinking?
I mean, I think, they don't think they're evil. They don't think they're evil. They think they're right. They think we are superior. They think we don't need these babies. What was that word that Steve King used in his tweet? We can't restore our civilization with someone else's babies.
Yeah,
I mean they think they're right. They think that black folks drag the country down, that brown people drag the country down, that they are superior, that the European English way, the history, civilization of Europe is a superior way. They deeply believe it. So that translates into personification of evil to me. Personification of evil are people who don't even think of themselves as evil, but are people who think of themselves as right and just and fighting for the right way.
Yeah, and any time that someone will sacrifice individuals for this idea of we're doing this in the right way. This is the demand of history or the demand of biology or the demand of all of those big ideas that led to the totalitarian slaughters of the 20th century. You see that true believerness mixed with this that same horrible cynicism. It's like the worst mix of, like, you're right, they really believe it, I think, while simultaneously being ultra cynical about everything.
Right. I want to be very clear. This is not a trivial matter. This is not something to be taken lightly about what we're facing.
Yeah.
They've got 4 years to be in power, maybe more.
Yeah.
You know, so this is a lot of damage can be done to our country and to the people taking away voting rights and more in this country over the next 4 years. That is pretty frightening.
Yeah, I mean, we're sitting here just still basically days into when we look back in a year, we'll think, oh, we had no idea what was coming. And the first really bad disaster or catastrophe hasn't even happened yet. So on that note, we encourage you to download the podcast from iTunes before the internet goes away or something. And listen, stock it up. So, you know, store it like you would your canned goods so you can listen to it later. And this is Democracy in Crisis, and I'm Baynard Woods.
I'm Mark Steiner.
Much love and grim solidarity.
Mm-mm. We have to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we're going to hear a segment from our Steiner Show archives. A great discussion on the 20th anniversary of A Different World. Groundbreaking show that talked about the heart of HBCUs. All that coming up. Before we get there, though, I want to remind you, and before we get to the break, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com.